Thank you, Sebastian, for the introduction. So I'll be talking about work that is summarizing these two papers with collaborators at Stanford, at Washington, and at Tokyo. So I'm a Kenneth Matter theorist, so I apologize for many incorrect statements about high energy physics. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. This is my outline, so I will briefly summarize what is a topological insulator. It's a hot topic right now in kinetic matter physics. We'll see why. And then I'll discuss the work that we did, which is how to construct fractional versions of this topological insulator in 2 plus 1 dimensions and then in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So I'll describe both field theory description and a holographic description. So very generally, arguably, one of the main goals of kinetic matter physics is to discover and classify all stable states of matter. And we've been quite successful at that by using the broken symmetry principle, which we're very familiar with in high energy physics. But in kinetic matter, it's very useful as well. And the idea is that states of matter can be characterized by the symmetries they break. So a crystal, for instance, breaks the translation periodicity of real space. Of free space, a ferromagnet breaks the time reversal symmetry as well as the spin rotation symmetry. And an antiferromagnet breaks both the translation invariance and the spin rotation invariance. So these are examples. In all these cases, there is a physical, or there is an observable, which is a local order parameter. And this is basically the main object in the Ginzburg-Landau theory description of these states, and which is essentially a mean field theory description. And basically, at low energies, many of these systems have low energy fluctuations, which can be described by field theories of the sigma model type, which describe fluctuations of the order parameter. So that's interesting. But however, it turns out that there are states of matter which do not fall into this classification. And the first example of these states was discovered in 1980. So if I take a two-dimensional electron gas, a sheet of electrons, which can be realized, say, in a sandwich between different planar materials, and if I apply a strong magnetic field perpendicular to this two-dimensional gas of electrons, then we start having Landau levels. And what turns out is that when the field is high enough, and one measures the Hall conductance, so the transverse conductance or conductivity, then one sees that the value of this Hall conductance is very accurately quantized. It's an extremely flat plateau. And in fact, it's one of the most accurate measurements in kinetic matter physics. And it's used to define standard of resistance. So it's very, very accurate. Even in samples that are dirty and have disorder, and so it's quite interesting. Why would we have such accurately quantized values? So this is the quantum Hall effect. Interestingly, we can have phase transitions between states characterized by different values of the Hall conductance. Let's say from Hall conductance of 3 in some units and Hall conductance of 2. And it turns out there's no symmetry breaking across this phase transition. And there's no local order parameter. So we don't know how to describe these states in terms of the symmetry breaking framework. And other interesting observables, this state of matter, this quantum Hall state, it's an insulator in the bulk. So it's a system which doesn't conduct electricity except on the edge. So if I take this two-dimensional sheet, I will have gapless or massless fermions that move around the edge, and these are chiral. They orbit only in one direction. And so this is the first example of what we call a topological insulator. Okay, so why did I call this topological? So what is topological in this quantum Hall effect? Well, it turns out we can define a topological invariant from the wave functions of that system. So this is a non-interacting system. We can solve for the wave functions exactly. And it turns out that if I compute this invariant, this integral over the first Brillouin zone, the system is defined, say, on the lattice. And it turns out that if I compute this quantity, defined in terms of matrix elements of this derivative with respect to k, the momentum between different states, then we find that this quantity is an integer. It's perfectly quantized. And so why is this integer quantized? Well, physically, this looks like the flux of some gauge field, little f, through a compact surface, which turns out to be this Brillouin zone, which is topologically a torus. So we can think that this integer is like the magnetic charge of this gauge field, which is quantized because of Dirac quantization. And mathematically, it was quickly recognized that this is the first turn number of some U1 bundle on this torus. OK, so more importantly, physically, this integer is observable. So it's the Hall conductance that I mentioned. OK, so this is the first example of what is the quantum Hall effect. Just to point out, how is this related to some interesting high energy physics? So this quantum Hall effect can be viewed as a manifestation of the chiral anomaly in 1+1 dimensions. And the idea is the following. If I think about the fact that I have these chiral edge modes, OK, so that means I have a left mover on the bottom edge, say, and the right mover on the top edge. And if I combine this right mover and this left mover into a single Dirac fermion, a single massless Dirac fermion, I know that I will have this chiral anomaly equation. And in fact, it turns out that if you compute what is this change in the chiral charge, in the axial charge, well, because these two right mover and left movers are separated spatially, then this change in the chiral charge turns out to be the current in the y direction. Because of this anomaly equation, this rate of change is proportional to the electric field. And it turns out that because of that, it's a Hall conductance. OK, so this is just to explain how this is related to some anomaly physics.
So just make sure I get the terminology straight.
Right.
A topological insulator is something which is an insulator in the bulk that has some quantized conductance due to some topological invariant which lies on the boundary states.
Well, so this is true in this particular example of state. More generally, it's not you don't require to have a quantized conductance. You typically require that there will be some gapless modes on the boundary. But these modes could be neutral, for instance. So they may not conduct electricity.
So in general, what is meant by a topological insulator versus just a regular insulator?
Yeah, so it's an insulator. So it's a system which is insulating in the bulk. And it is characterized by some topological invariant, which is defined in terms of the bulk wave functions. OK, so there is a formula like this, which given the bulk wave functions, we can compute some quantity, which turns out to be quantized. And why is it topological? Well, it's topological because if I deform these wave functions a little bit, then this quantity will not change.
But it doesn't matter what physical property it refers to. It could be any property.
Yeah, the physical properties could be quite different. Okay. So for instance, well, in fact, my next topic is to describe these time reversal invariant topological insulators. And these ones have a zero Hall conductance. Okay, but they're still topological. So it really depends. The physical properties really depend on the particular type of topological insulator. Yeah, very good question. So right. So in the example of this quantum Hall state, because we needed this large magnetic field to create lambda levels and so on, and we were breaking the time reversal symmetry. So this begs the question of whether we can think about topological states similar to the quantum Hall effect, but which don't require a large magnetic field. So in terms of symmetries, that would mean that these states do not break time reversal symmetry.
Okay. Large magnetic field means large compared to something set by the impurities in the sample or something?
Yeah, so this statement only means that if I have a small, well, yeah, so typically, so these are insulators, right? So that means that there must be some large energy gap. And in this particular problem, the energy gap is tuned by the magnetic field. So this energy gap needs to be smaller, say, than the temperature or than the frequency at which you probe the system. So basically, this only means that the magnetic field needs to be large enough that the system is an insulator, really.
Oh, okay.
OK, because it's like if you think about some massive Dirac fermion. And in fact, this is what I will, it's the language I will use. If I think about a massive Dirac fermion with some energy gap of order m, the mass, then if I were at a temperature bigger than that mass, then for all intents and purposes, it's not an insulator. OK, so this is all I mean here, a large magnetic field. Right. So, okay, so yeah, so generically we want to ask whether I can have topological states which do not break time reversal, for instance. Okay, so that would mean, as you pointed out, in fact, if there is no magnetic field, then it turns out the Hall conductance, which is odd in the magnetic field, has to be zero. So that means that this Chern number has to be zero. So the topological invariant that will describe this potential state cannot be the Chern number. It's going to be something else. Okay. So all right, so let me move on to this time reversal invariant topological insulator, in two dimensions, also called the quantum spin Hall effect. And I'll describe the original version of that system and then describe how one could, in principle, fractionalize this system. And I'll define what I mean by fractional as well. So, if we don't want to rely on the magnetic field to generate a topological state, well, we may want to look for other kinds of physical mechanisms that may help us. So, for instance, what happens if I think about spin-orbit coupling? So, talking about non-relativistic systems here, obviously. If I write spin-orbit coupling in that way, it looks like a vector potential dot into the momentum. So it looks like some kind of vector potential, but the vector potential depends on the spin. Okay. So what if we would like to imagine a system where this vector potential could give rise to a magnetic field? But now this magnetic field depends on the spin, such that, let's say, the spin-up electrons feel a magnetic field which points up, and the spin-down electrons feel a magnetic field which points down. Okay, so there must be this symmetry between the effective magnetic field and the spin because of time reversal symmetry. So this effective field, if you will, if I flip the spin, then I also flip the sign of the field. So I'm just asking what happens if we had this kind of field configuration, then we would have a system like this. So we would have essentially two copies of this quantum Hall system, but each copy consists only of electrons of only one spin. Okay, so now the spectrum we would have would look like this. If I were to look at, let's say, only focus on only one edge, then I would have, let's say, a left mover of a given spin, and also a right mover, but with the other spin. And I would also have bulk states, which are massive. Okay, so these are states here, which are localized if I'm in this energy range. Okay, so this state would be T invariant, and by construction, because I've really just tensored added two copies of the quantum Hall system, then the system is an insulator in the bulk, and it has these gapless modes. Okay. Now the question, are these modes really gapless? Because in principle, I have a crossing here. You know, if I have a crossing, then maybe this crossing opens up if I have perturbations. But it turns out that as long as I require time reversal symmetry, then at least at the non-interacting level, this matrix element, which would couple these two states, vanishes because of time reversal symmetry. So that means that this crossing is protected. And so as long as the symmetry is preserved, which is what we required to start with, then this state is stable, and these edge modes are stable. Okay, so this state was dubbed the quantum spin Hall state, was proposed first by Kane and Mealy, 2005. And now the question is, well, can we actually have such a state? And it turns out that yes, the state has been realized, or at least it's strongly believed so. So it was predicted in a particular semiconductor in 2006, and several measurements. I won't go into the detail of the measurements. Feel free to ask me if you'd like to know more, but I just want to say that there is strong evidence that this state has been observed in nature. Okay. All right. Now I will describe a simplified version of that state, which corresponds very much to what I've just described, namely, I will focus on the model of decoupled spins. Okay, so I have spin-up electrons feeling one magnetic field and spin-down electrons feeling another field. And there are more general versions of this, including the experimentally verified system. But in this talk, I will just focus on this simplified version. Okay, so that means the following. So going back to this Chern number description of quantum Hall states, well, if I have two spin systems that are decoupled, then I can define a Chern number for each of these. So the spin up state would have, say, a Chern number and up, and the spin down state needs to have a Chern number which is the opposite of that spin up state, because the total Chern number needs to vanish for the system to be time-reversal invariant. So I will define this total Chern number to be the charge Chern number, if you will, which is really the Chern number of the system, which measures the charge, the Hall response. But I can define a spin Chern number, okay? And this spin Chern number in the system would be non-zero. So what is the meaning of this spin Chern number? Well, the meaning of this spin Chern number means that we would observe a spin Hall conductance. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that if I apply an electric field, then because each of these subsystems basically has a Hall effect, then there will be a transverse current, but the direction of this current will be opposite for both spins. So that means that this is a spin current. So meaning up electrons going to the right, and left electrons, down electrons going to the left, they both contribute to the spin current. So that gives me a spin Hall conductance, which would be quantized in that particular limit where the spins are decoupled. All right, so this is almost correct. However, this is not entirely correct. The statement is that in the quantum Hall effect, really, this Chern number could be 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, corresponding to the values of the Hall conductance, and all these values define different states that are all stable. And now, actually, it turns out here that this spin Hall conductance would be stable only modulo 2 in units of e over 2 pi. So what is the reason for that? Well, let's think about this from a chiral anomaly perspective. Okay, so let's think about this spin rotation symmetry. So I said that spin up and spin down are separately conserved. That means that, well, first of all, there is a U1 symmetry associated with the conservation of spin. And if I think about, again, separating the spin up electrons and the spin down electrons on different edges, then I also have a chiral anomaly associated with this U1 symmetry. Now, so I would think, okay, so depending on the value of this integer, then I could have any value of the spin Hall conductance. However, now what happens is that these edge fermions can become massive in pairs. So in the case of the quantum Hall effect, if I look at only one edge, all the electrons move to the right. So it's impossible for them to become massive in pairs. They can't, the spectrum cannot be gapped. Okay, it's a chiral spectrum. It's just there's a one line which has positive slopes. It's impossible for these fermions to gap out. However, in this case, although I cannot couple fermion number 1 up with fermion number 1 down because of time reversal symmetry, I can couple fermion number 1 with fermion number 2. And since I couple a right mover with a left mover, then I can gap this part of the spectrum, and similarly with the other one. So that means that I start with a system which has these massless fermions, but these perturbations, which are allowed by symmetry, will remove these massless fermions, and the anomaly will disappear. So that means that I would not have this protected spin Hall conductance. So, however, if I have an odd number of these, then one of them will remain, one pair of them will remain, and that's why the conductance is preserved modulo 2. So I will call this a Z2 spin Hall conductance. So in this very simplified model, this is where the Z2 that you may have heard about comes from, okay, so in this simple model. All right. So let me move on to some microscopic realization of this. So what I mean by this is, what kind of system of electrons could two-dimensional electrons could give rise to this particular effect? Okay, so let's think about the fact that, okay, the system has to be a bulk insulator. So I could take, for example, the massive Dirac fermion in two dimensions. So it's an insulator in the language of kinetic matter physicists because it has an energy gap. And okay, so the problem is that the mass term for a Dirac fermion in 2 plus 1 dimensions breaks time reversal. So that seems to tell us that we have an insulator, but it would break time reversal symmetry. Okay, let's bear that in mind. And furthermore, if I integrate out these fermions, I generate a transcendence term, which is also called the parity anomaly. Okay, and so what this transcendence term means for our purposes, well, it's a quantum Hall response, really. So if I integrate out these massive Dirac fermions, I end up with this term, where this would be the electromagnetic field. And if I just look at what is the current, electric current, it's proportional to the transverse electric field. And this integer here would simply give me the value of the Hall conductance. Okay, so this is what I get. For a single copy of a massive Dirac fermions, I would get a 1/2. On the lattice, I would get an integer. So that is a quantum Hall system. Now, if we want to generate a quantum spin Hall system, well, we know the recipe. It's very easy. We can just take two Dirac fermions with equal and opposite masses. So that will ensure that the system is invariant under time reversal symmetry. So one flavor I will call spin up. The other flavor will be spin down. And now if I integrate out these fermions, I end up with a mixed transcendence term, or if you will, a BF term, type BF term, which basically means that the spin and the charge are coupled. And again, if I look at the spin current, if I take a functional derivative of this action, then I end up with the spin Hall effect. Okay, so this is just a description of what we already knew. I can realize this system, this quantum spin Hall effect, with two Dirac fermions with opposite masses. All right. Okay, so let's move on to the fractional part of this talk. So we know that the quantum Hall effect can in fact be generalized to what is called the fractional quantum Hall effect. And the fractional quantum Hall effect means that the conductance is not an integer multiple of this basic unit. It can be a rational multiple of this basic unit. So in the simplest case, which are known as the Laughlin states, the conductance would be, let's say, 1/3, where fifth, this n would be an odd integer. Okay, so this has been observed experimentally shortly after the discovery of the integer quantum Hall effect. All right. Now, if I think about my Dirac fermion picture, well, I cannot generate a fraction if I start from a free Dirac fermion. If I start from a free Dirac fermion on a lattice, I will always get an integer. Okay, so I don't know how to get, let's say, 1/3. So it needs to be a system which is not a free theory. Okay, so how? We're going to do that? So okay, that's a good question. This is the quantum Hall effect. In the case of the quantum spin Hall effect, I can also fractionalize in principle, in theory. I would like to have a fractional coefficient here. And again, this will not be a free Dirac fermion. So it cannot be two copies of Dirac fermions. It has to be something more than that. So how are we going to go about and try to describe what kind of physical system would give me this? So here I will give a very simple description. It's a microscopic model, but in a sense it's not. I'm kind of cheating here. I'm just putting by hand what I want to get, but at least we know what is it we want to get. So the idea is to use a parton model. Okay, so in this parton model, what I assume is that the electron will once it starts interacting with other electrons, it will start behaving as a composite of fractionally charged constituents, okay, which I would call partons. Here I wrote quark and gluon, but it's just obviously a very simple analogy. And so we would like this to happen. Okay, so far this is just a theoretical fancy. But let's see where it leads us. So what it means is that if I postulate that the electron inside the material will fractionalize into these constituents, So I will have these freshly charged particles, but I will also have gauge degrees of freedom, which ensure that the object that I started with is an electron. So what that means is that I want to make sure that these quarks, if you will, combine it to gauge invariant objects. And the electron here is my gauge invariant object. So this is the requirement if we start from a theory of electrons, which is what we would do in a condensed matter system. Okay, so that's why I need to have these gauge fields here. So
these gauge fields are dynamical. You think that
these ones would be dynamical. So in condensed matter, typically we think about the electromagnetic field as being not dynamical, but these ones would have to be dynamical at least in principle. There would be some coupling constant, and whether that coupling constant becomes real large, flows to a large value or small value, this depends on the details of the dynamics. But in principle, when I introduce this description, then I will generate some dynamical term for these gauge fields.
Okay. Is this supposed to be a collective phenomenon or
really right.
local?
Absolutely, yes. This would be a collective phenomenon. So my next slide will be the fact that in the quantum Hall effect, I do have fractionally charged objects. But certainly, these are not, I'm not actually cutting the electron in three parts. There will be some distribution of charge, which if I integrate that distribution of charge over some region, minus the background, then this will be E over 3 or something like this. So certainly that's what we have in mind. These are effective theories at long wavelengths and low energies, absolutely. Okay. All right, so in this kind of idea, if we assume that the partons are free, okay, we have to assume this, but if we assume this, then each of these partons are just free Dirac fermions with a fractional charge, and I can integrate them out. And if I integrate them out, then I generate a transcendence term, which gives me the right value of the Hall conductance. Okay, so certainly it's magical, but I put it by hand. But okay, it's kind of obvious, but this is what would happen. Okay, all right. But we have to assume that the partons are free. So. That's fine. Now we can do the same for the quantum spin effect. It's not very different. The only thing I have to assume now is that not only the partons have a fractional charge, they also have a fractional spin, which in 2 plus 1 dimensions, the rotation group is SO2. So in principle, I can have any value of spin. So I can take a fractional value of the spin. And now I have these gluon fields, if you will. Which are these dynamical emergent gauge fields. So we're done Lagrangian, but it's just what I said here. And again, if we assume that these partons are free, which is not obvious because they're interacting through all these dynamical gauge fields, but if for some reason they condense, they form a free state, then we can integrate them out, and then we generate what we wanted, an effective action for the electromagnetic and spin gauge field that has a fractional coefficient. And I would also generate some kind of mixed transcendence term for these dynamical gauge fields.
Right, the first are classic, the capitals are classical. The
yes, right. And certainly I will generate lots of other terms as well. Okay, I just wrote down the topological terms here, but certainly once I integrate these partons, transcendence term is not the only term I have. There's lots of other terms in principle, okay, Maxwell terms and others. But I'm just writing down the ones that give me the quantized response that I wanted. All right. So this is I did everything by hand, certainly. So what's the problem here? Well, certainly I had to assume that these partons are free. Okay. So that's one thing. I know that the transcendence term that I generate for dynamical gauge fields. I know that they will affect the dynamics, and in 2 plus 1 dimensions, we expect that these transcendence terms will ensure that the gauge fields are in a deconfined phase. So that tells us that, okay, our picture of free partons may make some sense, but they're still strongly coupled. So it's not clear that we can believe this derivation, okay, at least in my opinion. So what I will give here is it's a holographic realization of a strongly coupled parton model, and we'll verify that these transport properties that are described they still hold as strong couple. Okay, so this is what we will give. And so the description will be in terms of probe brains in a D3 brain background. And so it's really making use of the canonical CFT duality on a 2 plus 1 dimensional defect. So it's kind of what you would expect. So right. So this is what we're doing. So I just consider a stack of D3 brains, and which gives me my SU1 gauge sector. Certainly now it's supersymmetric. It's n equal 4 super Young Mills. I will consider this D5 brain, and the D5 brain will be extended along a slice of ADS5, and we'll wrap an S2. I will give a little diagram of which directions the brains are and the other slide, but you have the directions here. And right, so I will add this, this hypermultiplet basically will be generated because I have a finite separation between the probe brain and the D3 brains. And so this will give a mass to my fermion psi, this hypermultiplet. So these are, if you will, my massive fermions of my insulator, and they live on this. These are open strings that extend between the D5 and the D3, and so on the D5 I will have this gauge field A mu, which will be electromagnetism, and on the D3 brains I generate this dynamical gauge field. Okay, so as usual, I solve the equations to find what is the embedding of this D5 brain and the probe limit. So I assume that I can use the background geometry. So what do I have? Well, if I write the ADS5 cross S5 metric, I have the Minkowski piece, and I have the SO6 symmetric piece. These brains are extended, both of them, in the 2 plus 1 dimensional spacetime, because this is where I want to describe my physical system. Without the D5 brains, we know what the symmetries are. The system is isotropic in all these six directions. So this is a geometric realization of the SUFR R symmetry of the field theory. Now, if I add D5 brains without any separation, I break this SO6 symmetry down to two SO3 pieces. So the D5 is extended along directions 4, 5, and 6. Now I want to make this hypermultiplet massive. So I will put a separation between the D3 and the D5. So now this will break the SO3 in these three directions down to an SO2 piece. So now I can write this down explicitly. So I had this SO6 symmetric piece. I had a first piece, which was SO3 invariant. And then I have, I write the other SO3 piece like this. So there's a DX7 piece, and then there is rotations in the 8-9 plane. Okay, so it turns out that this U1 R symmetry here is my spin. Is my spin rotation symmetry here. So I will explain more physically a bit later. But this is what we will make use of to generate our mixed transiminous term. Okay, so now I can write down, I'm just rewriting the metric here, the full metric of my of my system. Now I will search for an embedding which is rotationally invariant. So this separation function and this radial coordinate R1, I will assume they depend only on the radial coordinate, okay, of this three sphere here, and not on the angles. And now I can I can write down what is the metric on the D5 brain. Okay, so has all these embedding functions, and if I minimize the action, then I crank the wheel and I find this solution where, okay, I find some constant separation, which is just some constant mass, and this radial coordinate will be zero. So as expected, this mass, this X7, is just the mass of my fermions, my bulk fermions. And so if I think about how the DeFi brain looks like, well, it extends not all the way to the Poincaré horizon. It extends only down to M. And OK, so this is the solution. That's the embedding. And now we will see how does this BF term for the Hall response arises. Okay, so far these are dynamical terms or kinematic terms. Now I want to look at the topological terms. So naturally I look at the Vesuminal terms. So if I just focus on the Riemann sector, if I write down this Vesuminal term, then for the on the D5 brain, so on the D5 brain, this is the piece that I get. So remember, F is this U1 gauge field which lives on this single D5 brain. This is electromagnetism for us. And now I have this Riemann 4 form, or its pullback on the brain world volume. So now what do we do? So now invoke some previous work. So this the solutions okay for all these forms have been worked out a while back. So it turns out that in this geometry, in the S5 cross S5 geometry, that's the form that the Riemann field takes. So it involves this R symmetry gauge field, AR, and the volume form of some S3 inside the S5, and then some coefficient. So this is just a solution, certainly at large n, obviously. But this is some known solution. And now the only other piece that we need to know to calculate what is the form of this Vesuminal term, well, because we will need to integrate, we will need to compute this integral on the brain world volume, so I need to pull back this form. And so what happens is the following. So because of the fact that the embedding doesn't go all the way to zero, only goes to M, it turns out that in the language of which portion of this three sphere that I was talking about is being swept by the embedding, it turns out one can look at the details of the embedding, but it turns out that, well, not the details actually, because it does not depend on the details, but certainly what happens is that the only half of the three sphere will be swept. Okay, so this angle will go from 0 to pi over 2 as the radial coordinate goes from infinity to this bottom here. So this is all we need to know. And so if we compute this integral of the Vesuminal term, then this piece will just give me half of the volume, half of the surface of S3. And then I have this BF term. Okay, so the result, as you can see, doesn't depend on the details of the embedding function. It only depends on the N of the SUN theory. So we get what we expected. So now let me just comment a little bit more physically. Why did this R symmetry turn out to be the same as the spin rotation symmetry? Well, so let's think about it in the following way. So if I think about N equal 4 super Young Mills in 3 plus 1 dimensions, then if I think about some direct fermions, then I have a right mover and a left mover. And if this fermion is massless, then these two pieces decouple, and I have two vial fermions. And so the U1R symmetry, turns out, acts as a chiral symmetry for these. So the right and the left fermions have opposite R charge. So that is known. Now, what happens is that I'm actually looking at a system in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And so effectively, you could think that we're compactifying one of the spatial directions. Okay, so the z direction basically becomes small, and then I have some momentum pz, which becomes some number, which turns out to be the mass of my fermions. And now, so this happens, and furthermore, the right mover becomes an up fermion, and the left mover becomes a down fermion in this language. And now, because of the fact that pz becomes just a number, so it turns out that now these fermions are not massless. Okay, they're massive in 2 plus 1 dimension. They're massive, but they're still decoupled. Okay, so here, a mass term doesn't mean that I'm coupling right and left, because there's no right and left in 2 plus 1 dimensions anyway. There's no chirality. So that means that I still have this the remnant of this symmetry. And in this language, it turns out to be a symmetry between up and down, okay? Because so both of them, these currents are separately conserved. So,
excuse me.
Yeah.
Can you just go back one slide?
Right.
Right. So the n here that comes in your fractional. Where did that come from?
Yeah. So sorry. So my normalization convention, it can be different. So here I wrote 1/n, but actually, so in their notation, it's here it's n, but that's because the partons. So my partons, if you will, my hypermultiplet has charge e over n, whereas I think in most normalizations, the hypermultiplet they have charge 1, the charge is normalized to 1.
So you put that in at the beginning.
Right. So it's just a matter of, you know, if I were to write down the field theory, really, if I were to write down explicitly my Lagrangian of, n equal 4 Supreme Young Mills, or in whichever way I would insert this electric charge, so for my hypermultiplet, the charge would be E over N.
So it's not, for example, a flux on your associated with the C1 gauge field on your bike ring or anything like that?
No. You know what? So honestly, where this comes from, I haven't done this whole derivation. Okay, this I've borrowed from the literature. But as far as I know, the issue of the coefficient here is because the usual normalization. So if I were to keep the usual normalization, I would end up with a BF term of that form. And FR plus AR wedge F. But that assumes that the coupling is of that form, EA, whereas I am describing a system of fractionally charged objects. So that means if both of them have an E, that would get a factor of E squared. And this is how I would get my 4 pi n. So that's the only thing. Okay, there's nothing else here. So that's why I'm saying this model, okay, so what I'm doing here is verifying that the predictions of the parton model are still valid, even if they are strongly interacting, coupled to these gauge fields that interact a lot. But it doesn't mean that I've written down a model of electrons, which gives me emergent fractionally charged constituents. Okay, this is what we would like to do, but we don't know how to do this yet. So
you're working in the large n limit. So
yeah, this is also in the large n limit. Okay, so
does
certainly.
Does this term go to zero?
Well, I mean, like I said, I think it depends how you do your accounting, but this is a term of order n. And so I think in the standard terminology, I can't really go there because I'm not a string theorist, but in the standard terminology, as far as I know, these terms are order n terms. So these do not disappear in the large n limit. Okay, so this is just a matter of how you normalize your things. Okay, so, yeah. All right, okay, so how much time do I have? 15 minutes? Okay, that's good. All right. Okay, great. So this was the 2 plus 1 dimensional version of insulators. Now let's move on to the 3 plus 1 dimensional version. Okay, so very briefly, is this possible? Can we have a topological insulator in 3 plus 1 dimensions? Surely it depends what we mean by it. So first attempts to generalize what was known in 2D to 3 dimensions was by trying to construct a 3D analog of the quantum Hall effect. In that case, the first generalization that was proposed is to consider a system which are essentially stacks of the 2D quantum Hall effect. So these are anisotropic states. They do have quantized properties, but they are not genuinely three-dimensional, if you will, in one sense. And they also break time reversal symmetry because they have non-vanishing Hall conductances. More recently, there was a proposal of some isotropic state, which is also T invariant. And so this is what we often refer to as the topological insulator, or 3D topological insulator. In that case, it's very analog to what I've just described. The system is a bulk insulator in 3 dimensions. And now it has surface states, okay, that live in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And these surface states are linearly dispersing. They are Dirac surface states. But now they're not one-dimensional fermions. They're 2+1-dimensional fermions. And one can construct some invariant, which is also a mod 2 invariant, mod 2 integer. And we can give a similar interpretation in terms of the fact that these surface Dirac fermions can become massive in chaos. Okay.
That's your question.
Yeah.
Do you have a way of writing the pan-theoretic Z2 invariant in the strong coupling case?
No. Well, so no, because the band theory is essentially free fermions.
Okay.
So there are generalization to weakly interacting systems and these kinds of things, but more or less they all boil down to so they cannot describe strongly correlated states, if you will. This is a description valid for weakly interacting states. So that's why the invariant that you get is only Z2. Okay, because right, because if you go to, for instance, if I just go back to the quantum Hall effect, if I think about a quantum Hall effect, I would compute this Chern number, which is an invariant, but it's always an integer.
Right, so that's again a band theoretic.
That's a band theoretic number. Whereas in the fractional quantum Hall effect, then you get fractional values. You cannot get a fractional Chern number if you try to think of it as a Chern number. So that's why. So this is the analog here. You can only get a Z2 invariant if you do band theory. But in this fractional quantum spin Hall state that we described, in principle, you get fractional values that are not captured by the Z2 formulation. So I don't know if this answers your question. But yeah, band theory is a good description for, band theory is the theory of free fermions on the lattice, more or less.
Okay, so sort of fractional quantum Hall effect, I mean, is there some topological invariant you can discuss?
Well, there's different ways to construct invariants, but they are not based on a band theory picture, or they will have to be something like, okay, like this parton description, right? So I said if I assume that the partons are free, then I can apply band theory for the partons, and then I have to recombine them afterwards, and then this is where the fraction comes in. So essentially that's what I did in my first description. Okay, so you can do that. So more or less many descriptions boil down to that, but the class of physical systems is much bigger than the class of free fermion systems. Okay, so that's why this gives a restricted description of topological order. Yes, very good question. So I won't go into the details, but these systems have been observed, these 3D isotropic topological inflators in very beautiful experiments. So this picture that you may see in several talks, if you go to condensed matter talks, so this is our Dirac fermions, basically. Okay, so this is very beautiful measurement, which turns out it measures the dispersion of these surface states. So it's quite well confirmed experimentally. Okay, now, so what is the analog of the Hall conductance here? Well, it turns out that it's an interesting property. So it has to do with the electrodynamics in the system. So again, I think about an insulator. So, what I have in an insulator is I have a dielectric, and I have maybe some paramagnet, and so it's described by some dielectric and magnetic permeability constants. And okay, so this is well known, this is Maxwell. However, in principle, I can always write down an E dot B term if I think about this is an effective theory. So this was done a long time ago. I will check and probably others as well. But so why do we generally don't write down these terms in Jackson and so on? Well, this term breaks some symmetries. It breaks inversion symmetry because E changes sign under inversion. It also breaks time reversal symmetry. Okay, so that means this term breaks these two symmetries, which we often hold dear. But in condensed matter systems, we know that we can break inversion. We can have strange crystal structures, and we can break time reversal. We have magnetic fields. So in principle, we should write down such a term. Okay, that's the first observation. The second observation is this term is an abelian version of the well-known theta vacuum, and so I could write it in this this way, okay, just to make connection with some well-known physics. All right, so now let me just argue why this theta angle, turns out, will be quantized if I assume that time reversal symmetry is preserved. So let me go briefly through this argument. So you've often heard arguments, perhaps, that invoke systems on Euclidean spacetime with periodic boundary conditions in all four directions. Here I will describe some simpler version of the argument where I'm really talking about a physical system, okay, a bulk system, so it does have periodic boundary conditions in space, but there is some time interval over which I'm observing the system. I don't need to have periodic boundary conditions on time, which is less physical for condensed matter system. So imagine I choose my E and B field to be uniform and in these directions, then I would have this term in the action. Now I will compute the integral over these terms. So because the fields are uniform, I can I'm free to break this integral into a product of two pieces. So I have an integral over a three torus here and over some time interval. So let me focus on this piece. So if I integrate this field B over y and z, well, this field B is in the x direction, meaning that it's normal to the surface. And so in fact, I am computing the flux of this field B through a closed surface, a spatial torus. Because of direct quantization, we know that this this quantity is quantized in units of the magnetic charge. Now, if I look at this piece, okay, so here this is not a three, this is not a two torus, but it is one. It is a cycle S1 and integral over time. So first, I write down the electron, the electric field as dTAx. I pick a gauge such that A0 is 0. And I compute this integral. So I have a difference of two terms at times T1 and T2. And now, well, at every time, remember that this system is, I have electrons, okay, in this system. They have been integrated out. But this came from an electronic system. And the electron wave function has to be single value. That means if the electron goes around this cycle at any given instant of time, it better pick up a quantized value of its phase. Okay, it has to go back to itself. So that's why both these terms will give me an integer times this multiple. And again, I end up having the same kind of factor. And if I multiply these two, and all these two pi's cancel out, and I end up with theta times an integer. Okay, so this is nothing but you know, single valueness of the electron wave function. So I need to invoke the fact that it comes from electronic theory. Okay, that's true. It's not built in the action itself, but
so here it's always built in.
Yeah.
Competitions will pay this number for U1 and 0.
Yeah, right. Well, I think the statement is.
So
it doesn't need, yeah, it's a prop. This is really, this is like a product of two first term numbers. It does not need to be quantized. Well, okay, so do you mean over Euclidean spacetime or over Minkowski spacetime?
I mean, what bothers me is if I take that time interval and I shrink it to nothing, then it looked like I got the difference between the same value, so it's zero.
Right.
It's a continuous process, so I don't see how I would have generated an integer anywhere in that process.
But also, this index for Euclidean.
I could make more sophisticated versions of that argument, but I think that is the argument.
Right. Right. Let's see. If you were to shrink this. Right, that's a good point. So you're saying this integer here would be time dependent here.
But it can't be, so it'd be zero.
Right.
Unless you have a defect.
Yeah.
Yeah, there could be a defect. Yeah.
Right, I think one could, right.
It's a slightly different theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Well, if the, right. However, if the, well, if the difference, the difference is only an integer, right? So this ambiguity.
You're just saying the only integer is continuously connected to zero.
Zero, right, right. yeah, that's a good point. Right. So, however, if you change this number by one, this will not affect the partition function. We agree about that, right? This will yield a change This will multiply. Let's see. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Zero is an integer.
Right. Right, right. Right.
I mean, if they're gauge equivalent, not equal, you get an integer. Is that not allowed by that? I mean, for some reason, that's not allowed.
Well, I mean, as David pointed out, the one thing that could go wrong with my argument, shrinking the time interval, is if there's a defect in the system. So if at some time there's a qualitative change in the system, then this argument doesn't work. But you know, the way you formulate it, it's sure could shrink that interval to zero.
Yeah, I mean, right. There's probably some adiabaticity. Adiabaticity argument here. That is a good point. So here I did the integral over time first. I think one can also do an argument. Yeah, but let me not speculate here. That is a good point.
Converging periodic, or those fixed endpoints?
Excuse me?
Converging periodic, those are fixed endpoints.
Yeah, here I chose fixed endpoints, yeah. Because, yeah, right, exactly.
For a periodic, you have a twisted
value. T4 number.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is T3
plus. Right, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, often the argument is given on T4. Right. Actually, yeah, so the details of this argument are given in this work, actually. So, but yeah, that's a good point. I can't think of what is the issue, the resolution of this paradox here. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. So pending this resolution of this paradox, we do have this periodicity in theta. Okay, and so that means that, so now if I impose a constraint of time reversal together with this periodicity, that means that I only have these two possible values. Okay. And so it turns out that a topological insulator is an insulator with this term, with theoretical pi in its electromagnetic response. Okay. So this is what. So let me skip over this, and just very briefly, the prediction of what happens. I won't go into the details here, but the statement is that the topological insulator has theoretical pi, and the vacuum has theoretical zero, and there must be an interface here. And if there's an interface, then there's a domain wall, an axion domain wall, which has been studied a while back. And it turns out that if you restrict your observation to the surface, then you end up having a transcendent term on the surface, and there's a quantum Hall effect on the surface. Okay, so this is, all right. So I will just very briefly generalize my description to the three-dimensional system. It's very simple. So once again, I imagine some parton decomposition. And now each of these partons form a topological band insulator. And if I assume they are free, I can integrate them out. And if I integrate them out, I generate these theta terms. And one can show, I will not go into the details, but really the argument is very simple. If I have fractional charges, then I can get a fractional theta. That is really the only conclusion. And again, one can describe this holographically. Now it's really SUN n equal 4 super Young Mills with a D7 brain to describe a 3 plus 1 dimensional system. And an axion domain wall can be constructed holographically, and we can verify that the prediction of the parton model hold as strong coupling large n as well. So that is what I wanted to say. So to conclude, these time-reversal invariant topological insulators have been experimentally observed. At least their surface states have been observed. So by analogy with the fractional quantum Hall effect, we can construct theoretically fractional counterparts if we use parton, at least at the level of a parton model. If the partons are free, then we can derive effective gauge theory simply by integrating the partons out. And these are essentially the well-known parity anomaly and axial anomaly, more or less. That's what it is. And if the partons are strongly coupled, we can confirm these predictions with a holographic construction. And so this is my conclusion, and I'll just leave you with these a few questions. So certainly, it's kind of obvious, at least to kind of smatter people, what we would really want is a theory of interacting electrons from which this kind of partner model emerges. Okay, that is much more difficult. But we would like something like this. Maybe holographic can help us. I don't know. Please let me know if you think it can. Again, we may want to see what happens to the surface states, presumably. Let's say in the 3D case, we had these free Dirac fermions for a non-attracting topological insulator. For a fractional one, we expect that we will probably have a non-Fermi liquid. So it would be interesting to describe this maybe holographically as well. There's lots of work on non-Fermi liquids with holography, so maybe this can be useful here. And finally, other gauge groups can give even more exotic types of states with the non-abelian statistics and the like. So thank you very much for your attention.
I don't think I understood your conclusions about the 3 plus 1.
Yeah, let's see. Right. Which parts?
Well, the conclusions were.
Oh, the conclusion? Right. Right.
You went through this analysis, you essentially said you didn't trust it.
Oh, no. I think this analysis is very, very similar. So I didn't give the details. So this is not my work. So Andreas and others did that. But it's a very similar kind of construction. And no, I think everything is fine. They have a similar holographic description. I was just saying that the free parton model, you cannot believe, exactly, yeah. But so exactly, if it's less than before.
You never believed it before, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. We believe in. Sorry, say that again.
Often state is not a state of free plasma particle.
Right. So yeah, I mean, this is a physical picture. I mean, I can construct a parton state which gives me 1/3 Hall conductance and gives me all the physics of the Laughlin state. Yeah, that's a good question. It's not. You're right. It's not the same as the Laughlin. Well, actually, in the case of the Laughlin, in the case of the Laughlin wave function, it is the same state because the Laughlin state is given by, if I think about the 1/3 state, so the 1/3 state in terms of all these electron coordinates, large n, sorry, 1 to n, will be given by a product smaller than j, and I think it's bi, the nth power with some factor, z, some over I, something like this. But if I think about the nuchal 1 state, it is basically the same state, j, without. Also, yeah, so this is the 1 over m state. So this would be just 1 and then times this factor. So I can construct a parton state by saying, OK, my trial state will be a product of 3 nuchal 1 states and with basically 3 flavors of partons, 1, 2, and 3. Zi3, and then at the end of the day, I will glue all these partons back together. So I will say all the Zi's are all the same, and then I end back on, because now it's a product of 3 wave functions. I end up with.
Must be all the same. That constraint is.
Right. Right. Exactly. So that yes. Yeah. So that constraint is basically the G infinity limit, but in that case, this is 2-dimensional. So this, it's okay because in 2+1 dimension, I have a Chern-Simons term. Even if I go to very strong coupling, I will not get confinement.
It's just circular.
Yeah, right. So yeah. So yeah.
So one is I have 3 guys and I have a Lagrangian and I integrate out and I get the Chern-Simons. also for the holographic representation.
Right, right, right.
But then, in fact, the direction is infinitely strong.
Right.
So go ahead and put that into the dynamics and then integrate that.
Right. But that's what the holographic description did, right? They were integrating. The partons were interacting through a gauge field.
Yeah, except that. Yeah, except there, you ended up with something, whether that's electron.
Right.
I think that's at the level of kinematics and dynamics.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. And well, this is why we would like a model of interacting electrons with non-gauge interactions, just regular interactions and no other degrees of freedom, and these ones emerge. So certainly, I mean, these kinds of questions in the quantum Hall effect can be answered at the level, well, tri-wave functions and doing exact diagonalization on electrons interacting through Coulomb interaction. And then, yes, then we can verify these pictures, but otherwise, it's very difficult to do. Yes, I agree.
Questions? And then you have another argument that the issue in gauge theory, so theta equals pi.
Yeah.
Breaks for large n, which is why you trust this.
Yeah, but this is, yeah, right, but this is for pure SUN gauge theory. Yeah, so certainly that's why we said, okay, so we want some kind of SUN gauge theory, but there could be neutral degrees of freedom, which do not, okay, the spectrum would not be gapless, but these light or massless degrees of freedom can get rid of this problem, and the system is electrically insulating, but it doesn't mean it's a massless state. So certainly here, for instance, if I think about a topological insulator with the statistical gauge factor being SUN equal 4 super Young mils, this is massless. And so my insulator is massless. So it's not a gap system. But these degrees of freedom are not coupled to electromagnetism. So it's like phonons, if you will, in an insulator. So these are neutral. The spectrum is not really gapless, but they're neutral. But yeah, certainly for pure gauge theory, this is true. But this is not true, because for any theta, this is still conforming.
But presumably, what the interest in this, aside from just general thing, is that you might get, if this was real huggable, and it suggested there might be real materials that had such fractional states, you could get more interesting anions that would be non-abelian and true quantum material.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's this thing with the Majoranas, but I think it would be an example of a fractional state apart from, it's another example of topological order. That's what we're after. It kind of matter these days. You know, we have the fractional quantum Hall effect, but we don't have other examples, and we're trying to find other examples. And roughly, the idea is topological insulators, so we just... They already give interesting things. If you have some perturbation on their surface, magnetism and superconductivity, you can get principal Majorana fermions and the like. I mean, none of these things have been measured yet. The only thing that has been measured is these direct cones, as I said before. And even this axion domain wall, this surface quantum Hall effect, we still, people are actively working on it to detect it optically.
If you look for holographic representations of those things, where you have this, try to put in superconductor.
These things, no, I haven't. I haven't, and lots of people work on holographic superconductors. But as far as I know, nobody has done that. So yeah, that's an interesting thing to study. I agree. The thing is, the physics of regular topological insulators is well understood at the level of mean field. So we don't really think like we actually need holography there. Certainly, if we want to describe fluctuation effects, that's something different. But yeah.